Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. I was talking with some musician friends recently who'd been touring, and one of them said, and they're veteran touring musicians, people have done lots of this, one of them said that the most glamorous thing about touring is saying, "We're touring." the rest of it's relatively grim, as somebody else that we were talking to on the weekend, also somebody who's done lots of touring, is like, yeah, the show's an hour of your life. Like, you spend all the rest of it in the truck, you know. It's not an easy life. Yeah, or schlepping stuff. Yeah, exactly. And in that sort of sphere, with that sort of in our imaginations, I want to mention the chorus from a song by a touring Canadian musician, Donovan Woods, who has a song called "Whatever Keeps You Going." And if you watch, there's a couple different official video versions of it, but one of them is he recorded the song twice, and on one of the versions, the chorus has a children's choir singing on it. And it's more of an acoustic version, and the kids' chorus really fills it out musically. And in the music video for that, he's at home getting ready to leave on a gig. He's got the two guitar cases, and he's tuning things and putting them in the case, and the house is dark. It's early in the morning. And the chorus, when you hear the chorus, you see projected on the wall of his house this screen with all these kids' faces from the choir, like with their headphones on in their different settings. I think it was recorded during COVID, so they're not together in the same room, but they're all singing on this chorus, like projected on the wall of the house. And he is himself a father, and you know, so you kind of get this image, literal image, of hitting the road alone in the dark, because of these things you care about. And the chorus of the song says this: whatever keeps you going, keeps your wheels rolling, whatever helps you sleep at night or gets you up in the morning, it might be something you hate or you love or you can't let go of, but whatever keeps you going. And at the risk of making a rather large category of human experience way too simple, I'm going to suggest that when it comes to thinking about what keeps us going, there is one word, there is one sort of a big idea that can at least represent what we need to keep us going. And I think a good word, or as good a word for that as any, is the word hope. Hope covers a lot of ground for us as human beings. I recently saw a film scene, the two characters are having this dialogue, they're friends, they're reflecting on what keeps people going when things get really brutal. And one of them is astounded that under the circumstances, the group of people that they're talking about, in this case, a group of immigrants, haven't just given up and hopped on a ship taking them back where they came from. And to that character's way of thinking, even though their life back home was hell, it was the hell they knew, and that the most terrifying thing from this speaker's point of view, the most terrifying thing on earth was the unknown, which is what this group was facing. So why would they keep going? Why wouldn't they just get on a boat and go back home when that's what they had to face? It's sort of a better the devil you know than the devil you don't argument, right? His conversation partner is a black man who has had the personal experience of being in slavery in the context of the film's story. And his reply to that logic is this. He says, "That's because you've never been whipped. Let someone put a whip to your back and then tell me the unknown is what scares you." And that's sort of an anything must be better than the devil I know shape of an argument, right? And perhaps the constant or the shared ground in that conversation is something like, it's what keeps these people, what keeps any of us going, especially when the going gets difficult. And we could say, I think, in the face of both of those perspectives, that what keeps us going is what I'm using the word hope for. Hope that we just might be moving away from the hell, or even the mundane challenges, for that matter, that we know, even if we can't know with any certainty what we're moving toward. So the hope that we're moving towards something better. Talk with any runaway, literally, ideologically, metaphorically, and this is likely bubbling away underneath the surface. Why are you running away? Because I hope that where I'm headed is better than where I'm coming from. Hope. Well, to many of us, privileged as we may be, some of those illustrations might seem a bit too grim or distant. So let me frame this another way. Let's think about this in terms of what hope might point toward, what it might imply. If we use a word, if we use an idea like hope to speak about what we need to keep going, to survive, then I would say if we're using it that way, hope by definition implies the thought of something better. If things are really desperate, even the unknown might seem like it contains more possibility of better than whatever our current circumstances are, right? So if home is hell, then running away might seem better. If the ship is sinking, then getting into a little boat and rowing off into the horizonless dark might seem like the shape of hope. But there's another aspect to this that I think is true to the trajectory of those ideas and also a little bit brighter. I don't want to deny the heft of those, and also I think there's another aspect of this that's worth considering. And I think that notion is one for which we could use a word like happiness. If we can work with, I'm not taking it as a given that we can, but if we can work with the idea that our survival depends on hope of something better, we can probably also say that our survival depends on some idea of future happiness. Without some of that present somewhere in the story, despair does not live very far away. It's a little bit tricky, though, because, in terms of language at least, happiness, perhaps like love, is a word that gets used in lots of different ways, and I think some of the ways we use that word have a lot more substance than others. Maybe that's why Donovan Woods didn't write, "Whatever makes you happy," right? Whatever keeps you going. He wanted to be closer to the bottom of the experience, if you will, if we're thinking of it vertically. But if we can follow that through, if we can work with that, then there's some questions, I think, that come right after that. What is happiness? Where does it come from? And can it be both an ordinary, everyday kind of thing and also a more ultimate idea, more of a utopian ideal? Like, we're complex beings, right, us humans. So achieving something that we might call happiness is not straightforward. By way of illustrating that, when I come home after being away, our dog, Mika, goes bananas. She barks, she dances on her hind legs, it's very charming. She licks and nips whatever part of me she can reach. I get unconsidered puppy kisses. She's happy. She is animal happy. And just, by the way, she's just as happy to see me after I've been out to get something from the garage as if I've been away for a couple of days. It's a very simple, very rudimentary version of happiness, right? It's a version that is based almost entirely... perhaps entirely, I can't get inside her puppy brain, but I can see that it's based almost entirely on the satisfaction of sensory appetite. Animal happy. But as soon as we get past the layer of sensory appetite being satisfied, we're into complexity, like just one step, and we're there. And just so we don't get bogged down, I'm going to suggest that the places where many of us customarily look for happiness can be put into three big baskets. Wealth or prosperity. Health, and friendship or companionship. Lots of ways we could come at this, but I'm going to use those three baskets for this. And I want to take a little bit of time today to begin considering those three baskets with some questions in particular about the relationship between wealth and happiness. So I'll just start with basket one, and to ask what possible role that relationship might have in our own search for things like hope and happiness. And for now, I'm going to steer clear of religious notions of ultimate happiness or sort of all good forever. We'll come to those in due course. But for now, I just want to start sort of what's kind of right in front of us, which is with wealth and a pretty basic question about that. So here's kind of question one in this exploration. Does our material situation affect our happiness? Well, it's a rhetorical question, isn't it? At least on the surface. And the answer also is sort of obvious on the surface. Of course it does. even someone who chooses a life of poverty, needs food and shelter. Dead hermits don't meditate. Like, you know, there's this needs to happen for us to live. And one of the wider ways that we acknowledge that reality in our lived experience, and which we can see on the news on any given day, is we acknowledge that reality by doing things like making rules for war that say that it's illegal to deny non-combatants those things, food and shelter, or to weaponize them. And we get our backs up when those rules don't get followed. We would regard that as unjust. It's pretty close to the center of what we need as human beings, right? Without a certain level of material provision, even comfort, it's difficult to live with the dignity that those sorts of laws argue we all deserve as human beings. Just because we're human. That's the qualifier. We're alive. So, yes, wealth, or if that term feels too grandiose, just money, is an important factor in our human search for happiness. But then, of course, the next obvious question might be, how much is enough? All right, so wealth and prosperity bring benefits. As human beings, we need decent shelter, we need a healthy environment, we need nutritious food, clean water. We could say that those things are prerequisites for human happiness and the baseline of what helps us sustain something like hope. Pretty hard to feel hopeful if you're starving to death, right? I mean, I feel like I've seen people do it, but it's hard to sustain, isn't it? But there are benefits beyond that, right? And this is a space that most of us live in most of the time. A newer car, a bigger house, the latest gadget, the luxury of travel or extended leisure, options. These are the kind of things that might temporarily increase our level of comfort or daily convenience. So far, so good. But they don't come with any guarantee that they're going to bring lasting satisfaction or contribute, really, to an overall sense of well-being. In fact, having more stuff often leads to greater anxiety, stress, or worry. And even the luxuries can behave like that, as our community time conversation this morning illustrated quite directly. Anybody enjoyed any anxiety-free travel lately? Right? You know? And arguably, that's a luxury, isn't it? But also, sometimes it doesn't behave itself in the way that we would like in terms of happiness. And those kinds of feelings can even turn into things like anger or resentment. If somebody at the border starts checking my phone to see if I'm a threat, some of those emotions that I just talked about are, in all likelihood, going to be part of my experience of that, aren't they? The research on this, which I won't get into the weeds of, but it's pretty interesting, and it suggests quite clearly that once we get past the point, and I should qualify this would be research on this continent, and with that lens, once we get past the point where our needs are perceived as being met, and there's obviously more than a little bit of wiggle room in that regard, but once we get past that point, however we perceive it, material acquisition has only a temporary effect on what is often referred to as, in sort of the realm where that research is done, as mental flourishing. We get a bit of a kick from the new thing, and after that kick wears off, our happiness level returns pretty quickly to where it was before. It's kind of like we have a happiness homeostasis, a kind of a baseline that our psyche is aiming us at, and we don't feel great if we get too far above it, and we don't feel great if we get too far below it. That homeostasis is there for a reason. Beyond those kind of considerations, though, we can observe that although wealth, even what we might consider sort of the ordinary wealth of middle-class life, something that often gets talked about as a right in this part of the world, but which by any global measure is a privilege, even that kind of wealth creates a kind of bubble around those of us that have it. It protects us from certain trials, from certain indignities, for sure. Interestingly, complicatedly, is that a word? It also potentially alienates us from everyone who doesn't have that same circumstance or a similar circumstance, doesn't it? That's why we get stratified society. That's why we get socioeconomic class. It's kind of like, if we wanted to think about us as having a relationship with wealth, if we wanted to use a relational analog here, it's kind of like an unreliable friend, right? Sometimes it's pleasant to have around, and sometimes it just is a pain, and sometimes it actually causes suffering. And we can also see, and some of us know by experience, that all that stuff that tends to signify wealth to us in this culture is pretty fragile. One forest fire, one flood, one blast of unruly wind, and we're standing in our yard looking at a pile of former wealth, right? Like, it's pretty fragile stuff. And I'm not mentioning these things to sow fear. I'm mentioning them to point us toward potentially a different way of thinking about a path toward happiness. This is an obvious one. It's one we all live with. It's one we all interact with. But we're not really surrounded by alternative ways to think about it. So I want to offer a little different lens on that. All of those illustrations are about material wealth, all the illustrations I just used. And the happiness that is most readily produced by them is kind of like the happiness my dog demonstrates when I come home. It's pretty connected to what comes into me through my senses. It's animal happiness. It's not inconsequential. I'm not throwing shade on animal happiness, but I do want to point to its limits. But what about what we could call mental wealth, or even spiritual wealth, wealth that is grounded in, wealth that is based on things like love, things like compassion? What if we think about the things that accrue in that space with the language of wealth? That kind of wealth and the happiness and the hope that are associated with it are potentially independent of circumstances and certainly less dependent on circumstances. And as a result, they are much more difficult to take away from us. Change in circumstance doesn't have that result nearly so readily. Now, I realize that, at least from my own lived experience, that what I'm pointing toward might be so foreign to many of us that it sounds unbelievable. It's hard to believe. It's hard to access. So let me ask you, and let me ask myself this question. Do you know anyone that is materially poor but happy? Do we know anyone that is materially poor but hopeful? In my life, I've known and I know both. And my encounters with folks that I would describe that way circumstantially reminds me of how easy it is for me to lose sight of the possibility of hope and happiness that isn't dependent on what money can buy. That's a hard thing to keep in view. The state of my inner being, of our interior, we could say our spiritual life, is, to put it very simply, more important to our hope and happiness than anything that we can materially possess. We can be poor and live in a family where there's affection, where there's kindness and trust, and be quite happy. I know I've told this story before, so I won't belabor it, but I cannot, when I start thinking about this stuff, I cannot shake the experience of hearing kids squealing with laughter as they chase this tumbleweed with sticks across the sand of the Sinai Desert in a circumstance where I just could not see how anyone could survive, never mind thrive. And they were just screaming with laughter. There was joy in that moment in a set of circumstances where the presence of joy and hope were unimaginable to me. And maybe that is close to the root of the challenge for those of us who enjoy relative wealth and comfort, having to learn to imagine something that we're not familiar with in order to access it, that the access point is through imagination. Because our lived experience actually gets in the way of this, I think. And on the other hand of that sort of comparison about being poor and happy, I don't have to travel outside the city. I don't even have to travel outside of my neighborhood to be in contact with rich people who are suspicious, resentful, and afraid. In other words, neither happy nor particularly hopeful. That's a short walk. There's one other aspect of the relationship between wealth and happiness that I want to touch on today. There's a quite robust body of research that shows that not only are the mental benefits of wealth, material wealth, temporary, but also that the general level of contentment in a society is higher when wealth is more evenly distributed among the population than when there are large disparities between the rich and the poor. Well, duh, right? But also, as we like to say at our dining room table once in a while with the kids, once again, science proves the obvious. But, you know, there we go. There is the science does prove this as well. And I'm not just talking about here when the rich misbehave or when they leverage their wealth as power in ways that are flagrantly destructive. To keep it at least reasonably simple, we could say that this also points to well-being not being measured in material terms, but rather being dependent on our attitude toward or our relationship to wealth, which is an interior thing that we practice on the outside, but it starts on the inside. So as I was reflecting on this, what came to mind, and this is very contextual, you may not share this context at all, but what came to mind was these collected musings of of a character that is called the teacher in the text, and the text in question is the collection we call Ecclesiastes. I don't know if that's a book you've ever read, but if you have, you may have noticed that as a collection of ideas, and this is not unusual around ancient Near Eastern wisdom collections, but it can't seem to make up its mind about what the path to happiness actually is. I won't get into any kind of deep examination of this, but I think there's a couple of observations that come from those musings that might be relevant. So the book itself, which claims to be written by the ancient Hebrew ruler Solomon, starts off feeling very much like that conversation that I mentioned with some young adults recently. It starts off this way. The first verse just says, I'm Solomon and I wrote this. And the second verse says, meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. That's verse 2. Just so you got the motif, right? So you're not wondering where we're going here. The word that usually gets translated meaningless in English texts could just as accurately be translated as empty or frustrating or perplexing. Those would all be very reasonable translations of the Hebrew word. 10 times in the course of the collection, the author says that life is like chasing the wind. And this is from a person who had everything that counted as wealth in his context. He had fame, he had family, he had fortune, he had wisdom, he had song, he had the arts, he had slaves, he had silver, he had women. And yet, he's anything but happy. And no, I didn't leave women and anything but happy to the end as any kind of unique comparison. Because there's a context for that, I'll get to that. In fact, when you read the book, it seems like he's like teetering at the edge of despair. Like he's in a pretty pessimistic state. Why? He's got everything. Right? Well, if you really kind of spent the time and did the study and teased out the themes, it seems like there's 3 kind of big themes about why he's bummed. And he is bummed because life is unfair, and he's bummed because life is futile, and the way that he articulates that futility is that we can't know the future, and he's bummed because of uncertainty. I don't know about you, but that all sounds either contemporary or timeless, but it certainly sounds familiar. Right? It doesn't sound distant. So what to do? From the perspective of the teacher, there are these 2 recommendations. And the first one's pretty accessible, and the second one gets pretty complicated. So the first one is to enjoy life. Right? There's this noteworthy focus in the book over and over again on the everyday realities of things like work, the ordinary pleasures of the body, and relationships. Enjoy them. This is what you got. Lean in. You know? Have a nice dinner. Have some wine. Enjoy your companions, whatever shape that takes. Enjoy your work. Your toil under the hot sun was his context. Pretty straight up description of labor. Enjoy your labor. If you want it in a verse, and I'll use the language of the text, and we'll talk about that language in a moment. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. And then again, chapter later, there's nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live. We could consider that it's not about, from that perspective, it's not about having more in terms of the path toward happiness. It's about being more present to what we do have. If we have this day, if we have work, if we have company, those are things to lean into. That's part of what the teacher recommends. And the second category of recommendation in those texts is, I would say, considerably more complicated. Every bit is important. The second is to acknowledge that there's more to life than meets the eye, and to attend to that aspect of life if we want to be happy. And the author uses the language of God for that, as one would expect given the cultural context in which he's writing. He writes with the notions of the divine that are present in the culture in which he's musing. He also offers his advice in terms of what is good for man, by which he does not mean humankind. The author of Ecclesiastes is someone who owns hundreds of women. Like, we've got to kind of keep our heads straight about his perspective. And that's important, not simply as a about gender and value of human beings based on gender and all those kind of things. Of course, that's an important reflection. But also, it's an important reflection when we read his wisdom about what doesn't meet the eye, what's over the horizon. All right? All to say, when he writes about gender and value, he is a person of his context. When he writes about the divine, he doesn't cease to be a person of his context. And when you think about the way Solomon in Ecclesiastes writes about God, because the next part of this in Ecclesiastes is live well because judgment is coming, right? There's this theme of make the most of your days because that's what God gave you, and if you don't make the most of them, like, you know, you're going to get it. Like, there's judgment for that, right? So again, think about what we know about how Solomon governed. One of the first stories where we kind of have a story about is he wise or not is him kind of making these pronouncements about solving problems about whose baby is it and who should get what in a court dispute that he presides over, right? So no big surprise, Solomon's perspective on the divine is a lot like Solomon's perspective on himself. Right? It's as good an illustration as I know of from sacred text of how that works for us as human beings. Because it's right in front of us through the whole book. God behaves a lot like me. I work with the tools that I have access to when I make religion. That's what I've got to work with. This is how I think. This is how I experience the world. So when I think about God, when I think about the divine, when I think about what I can't see over the horizon, I'm going to use those same tools. Because what else would I use? So, all to say, the way he talks about what's good for man illustrates his context. The way he talks about God illustrates his context. When I thought about this in contemporary terms, because I'm thinking, how does this wisdom come over to us in this age? I was like, well, it's actually not that difficult, is it? This is why, for example, we have a vibrant conversation in this part of the world at this point in history about talking to the universe doing this and bringing us that, and are we cooperating with the universe? Because we're becoming aware that we're profoundly a part of this thing, materially, among other things, right? That's a tool we have to work with. So when we're trying to imagine what's over the horizon, just like Solomon, we're going to work with what we've got in trying to imagine that. The point that translates, so we don't have to take Solomon's perspective on the divine to do this important work. What we need to do it is zoom out, like the author of Ecclesiastes zooms out, see our whole context as best as we can, and in that setting, consider how we might pay attention to our spiritual reality as well as our material reality. When it comes to hope and happiness, if we don't attend to the spiritual aspects of this, if we don't think about how does this work beyond my lived experience, we stay trapped in our search for happiness in the realm of animal happiness. It's not unimportant. It's a very significant part of our lived experience. We should attend to it well. And also, it's not the whole story. And if that's all we attend to, that's what's going to limit our happiness and our hope. It's going to be dependent on those fragile things. When we consider what else might be going on in this story, that's where we start to imagine other reasons for things like hope and happiness. We'll give them the shape that we give them, just like Solomon gave them the shape that he gave them. We will work with the tools that we have. But this is the work that we need to do, as well as attending well to the things that are right in front of us that we can access through our senses, right? So the conclusion that the teacher comes to in very broad terms is something like this. Even though pleasure, materialism, money, even the pursuit of wisdom in Ecclesiastes are in the end futility and folly, so that's the conclusion he comes to, we can tilt toward happiness and hope by enjoying what we have, but not counting on it to deliver more than it can. The path to the biggies, like happiness and hope, are more likely to be found when we look for them in the mystery of what lies within and beyond us, in what we might use the language of the divine for, or of mystery, whatever language we choose for that realm. I would like to think, this is indefensible, so let me just say that up front. I would like to imagine that if Solomon had a chance, if the teacher had a chance to sit in on some of our conversations, at the end he would say something like we often say to one another, which is, keep exploring what you believe. Because that's the realm in which some of these things can be touched. That's the realm in which some of these things, I'm not going to say found, because I think the finding is what shapes us more than arriving at some destination where we're like, I've got it. And in fact, I think in some ways when we get to that destination of I've got it, and this is what the shape it has to have, we're immediately in danger of taking a belief and turning it into something material and moving it back into sort of the animal version of our experience, making it a material fact. And it needs to stay as a mystery to keep us moving into that beyond what we see realm. As with many of the things that I sort of have the luxury of musing about together with this community, I offer that to you for your consideration, not for your agreement. Things to think about, things to explore while we keep exploring what we believe. Peace.